Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. Former U.S. President Barack Obama once said, quote, "The United States remains the one indispensable nation." This was back in 2014. What he was saying was, the U.S. is the unipolar hegemon that nobody could live without America. But less than 10 years later, how well did these remarks hold up after a barrage of sanctions against China, Russia, Venezuela, and a number of others fails to hit them where it hurts? This week, we'll explore the rising multipolar world order. All right, let's get into the MO. Years ago, it was almost unthinkable, the U.S. losing its status as the so-called leader of the free world. Well, at least in the bubble of Washington, D.C., that is. 20 years ago, nobody in the swamp could have predicted the rise of China like this or the formation of the BRICS bloc. And President Obama, as little as 9 years ago, highlighted this belief himself. Listen.
In fact, by most measures, America has rarely been stronger relative to the rest of the world. Those who argue otherwise, who suggest that America is in decline or has seen its global leadership slip away, are either misreading history or engaged in partisan politics. Think about it. Our military has no peer. The odds of a direct threat against us by any nation are low and do not come close to the dangers we faced during the Cold War. Meanwhile, our economy remains the most dynamic on Earth, our businesses the most innovative. Each year, we grow more energy independent. From Europe to Asia, we are the hub of alliances unrivaled in the history of nations. So the United States is and remains the one indispensable nation. That has been true for the century past, and it will be true for the century to come.
Well, a lot sure has changed in a decade. Washington may fancy itself indispensable, but does the rest of the world agree? 20th century wars waged by the West helped shape U.S. hegemony, but in the 21st century, as Bill Clinton's strategist and advisor, James Carville, famously said, "It's the economy, stupid." So joining me to discuss this and the rise of the multipolar world, he's an award-winning author and activist, John Steinbach. He's also the co-founder of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Peace Committee and of the National Capital Area. So John, thanks for joining us. I'll dive right in here. In the 20th century, following World War II, the U.S. emerged as, I think we can all agree, the world hegemon. How much of that had to do with their use of nuclear weapons on the civilian population in Japan?
I would say virtually none whatsoever. Many of the Japanese historians and some American historians believe that the atomic bombings had actually very little to do with the decision of Japan to surrender. Overwhelmingly, it was the Soviet declaration of war and their actions in Manchuria, which destroyed the Japanese army in a matter of less than a day, that was the precipitating factor that led to the end of the war. That the atomic bombings were, even when the surrender was negotiated, the Japanese leadership was not really understanding or aware of the significance of the bombing of either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So in that sense, it had very little to do with it. In another sense, the fact that the U.S. had a monopoly on nuclear weapons and initiated the arms race and immediately started testing the nuclear weapons and built up an enormous arsenal, during which time the Soviet Union had no nuclear weapons, had a lot to do with some of the initial successful efforts by the United States to assume largely to assume control of the global economy. And so ever since then, nuclear weapons have been used to kind of freeze the status quo, so that which benefits the United States. And Daniel Ellsberg, among others, at least 27 times has identified times when the U.S. has used the threat of nuclear weapons in order to get its way. And usually it's been against the third world countries and non-nuclear countries.
Why is the U.S. threatening nuclear war with Russia now?
Well, so Russia actually changed its policy. So now its policy is it can use nuclear weapons if the existence of the nation is threatened. And this is in conformance with the World Court decision about 13 or 14 years ago, which said that generally speaking, use and possession of nuclear weapons is illegal, except if the threat of the nation is at risk. And it's important to understand perceptions, because this is what got us in trouble in the past with the Cuban Missile Crisis and the nuclear crisis of 1983, was a lack of understanding how the other side felt. And Russia has been very clear, particularly since 2008, that it identifies the expansion of NATO and particularly the NATOization of Ukraine as red lines that cannot be crossed. So from the Russian point of view, whether you agree with it or not, from their point of view, the existence of Russia itself is at risk. And so therefore their policy would be, in that case, they would reserve the right to use nuclear weapons. And by the way, the U.S. policy is very similar, but even more liberal, if you will. So the Biden administration's nuclear posture review came out, and it's essentially a continuation of Clinton's and Bush's and Obama's and Trump's. And it still says, you know, we reserve the right to use nuclear weapons, you know, if in extraordinary circumstances, and they talk about specifically about Iran being a target. So in a sense, the more things change, the more they stay the same, or vice versa.
The U.S. argument tacitly is that under effective U.S. rule of the world, more people's lives have been improved, especially in the way of economic development of what we used to call third world countries. They're now referred to as developing nations. But does that argument really hold any water? I mean, has following a U.S. lead really bettered the world?
So that argument goes all the way back at least to the Roman Empire, the idea that we are, you know, civilizing the barbarians. That was the way the Romans put it. You know, starting, you know, even before Columbus, you have literally dozens, if not 100 or more, papal bulls, all of them justifying the subjugation of the rest of the world in the name of civilizing the barbarians. The Victorian British, you know, took it to extraordinary levels. And I think it would be most exemplified if the listeners go on Google and look up White Man's Burden by Rudyard Kipling. So these arguments have been made forever, but when you actually look at the reality is that all of these empires and the United States empire, they want the resources. They want the oil and the gas and the lithium and the iron and the copper, and they want markets, and they want slave labor, cheap labor, slave labor, and they want no environmental rules, so that everything gets shipped off to the third world or the rest of the world. So in that sense, it's just profound hypocrisy when they talk about, you know, bringing civilization to the rest of the world. It's Gandhi talked a little bit about Western civilization, and Gandhi said, well, that would be a good idea.
Now, the last many centuries, we saw the world through a unipolar lens. We can reflect on history for that. At one point, the Spaniards seemed to rule the world. That's why, you know, we have that saying, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Then the British colonial era, where England was the hegemonic world power. Then came the U.S. But over the last 40 years, those aforementioned developing nations have grown very much. China has become the second largest economy in the world. India is number 6 based on GDP, Russia at number 11, Brazil number 12. All these states are members of BRICS. They all say the 21st century will be a multipolar one. Would you agree? And what does a multipolar world look like?
I think in one sense, we're reverting. We're seeing an epochal change and a reversion to the norm, because historically throughout human civilization, there hasn't really been a unipolar world, even with the Roman Empire. They, of course, that did not reach to the great civilizations of the Western Hemisphere. It didn't really impact that much on the Chinese civilization, which is thousands of years old, and other civilizations as well. So I think that what we're seeing after World War II, the United States was in an unprecedented position of advantage. It had ramped up industrial production. There were still vast numbers of resources left, vast supplies of oil and gas and other non-renewable resources. And the United States took advantage of that. It took control, more or less, of the United Nations. It invented the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and controlled them all. So the United States entered into what Luce called the American century after World War II. But that was temporary. There was always the Soviet Union, which represented an ideological challenge, not necessarily an economic one. But today, it's a different matter. And you talked about the BRICS. But just for example, Lula won the election in Brazil. So the majority of the nations in Latin America now are liberal left led. And around the world, you have the Saudi Arabia now making nice with Iran because the United States is threatening OPEC. In fact, the United States is threatening everybody, threatening China, cutting off chips, sending Pelosi to Taiwan. You know, all of this stuff is serious stuff, and it's not making the U.S. friends. And I think that I would say, safely say, the vast majority of the people and the intellectuals in the third world or the rest of the world, the majority of the world, you know, have a long historical memory, and they know that the United States has been ripping off the world for the last 70 years.
All right, John Steinbach is sticking around to unpack more on this issue. And coming up next, NATO was supposed to be a joint effort to combat the Cold War against the Soviets, but has that objective shifted to simply maintaining the U.S.-led world order? We'll discuss it when we return. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
Baikal, a magical place, fantastical ice, clean waters, a dramatic geography, and of course a unique ecosystem which has developed over the past 25 to 35 million years. And of course a place like this just beckons you to come and experience it all for yourself.
On Inland Visions, coming up on RT International.
When all truths seem wrong, when all rules just don't hold, and a new world is yet to shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
The Cold War ended, or so we thought, when the world witnessed the fall of the Soviet Union and the two Germanys reunited. That was in 1991, just before Bill Clinton came into power here in the U.S. But as more and more White House communications from that period become public, we learn that perhaps NATO kept the Cold War alive, at least mentally. All right, John Steinbach is back to continue the conversation with us. So, John, nine countries are known nuclear powers: the U.S., Russia, China, the U.K., France, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel. So we talked about this at the top. Of the nine nuclear-capable states, only the U.S. has used them. What role do nukes play in either maintaining power or in even growing a state's power on the global stage?
So we talked about the role of nuclear weapons in the U.S., which is to maintain the status quo to the U.S.'s advantage, or in the case of conflicts, to end the conflicts to the United States' advantage by threatening to use nuclear weapons. From the Russian point of view, their perspective is that since the end of the Cold War, that despite assurances that the NATO has moved inexorably right up to Russia's borders and has been building bases on the southern border as well, and at the same time has been more militarizing Japan and Philippines and Okinawa and now is militarizing Taiwan and surrounding China. So from the point of view of the Russians and the Chinese, it's mainly a deterrent factor. And then I think if you look at Israel, their rationale is that they're surrounded by hostile states and they're willing to use their weapons as the Samson option. In other words, when defeat is imminent, they're going to pull everything down with them, and they're basically going to take everybody out. With India and Pakistan, it's a long, long history of really intense conflict and distrust, and in a sense, that's the conflict between India and Pakistan is one that is very unstable and could result in easily result in a nuclear war. So each one has different reasons. So I would say that when Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi in Libya got rid of their weapons of mass destruction programs, we can see what happened there. So if you look at North Korea, it's very clear the North Korean government feels that nuclear weapons are their ticket to avoid total destruction. And when you look at what happened to North Korea during the Korean War, I think their fears are understandable.
All right, let's assume someone has never heard the terms unipolar world or multipolar world. How would you explain or describe these terms to them and the consequences of each?
Well, I think it's an inexorable process that's happening before our eyes. So when we're talking about a unipolar world, a perfect example would be the world economy after World War II, when the United States exercised almost complete control. I mean, certainly there was trading going on back and forth, China with Australia and Russia and China, and all of these economies actually became integrated into the global economy. But it was dominated by the U.S. and using military force. We now have about 800 bases around the world. No other nation comes close to that. The U.S. military budget is approximately 10 times more than the next 10 largest militaries in the world combined, and most of them are allies in the U.S. So that would be a perfect example of a unipolar world. The idea of a multipolar world is one that is what we're seeing today, which involves Russia, which is a strong industrial economy, but it also has tremendous amounts of resources. And in fact, it's probably the closest to what we would call an autarky today, which means it has everything that it needs to maintain its economy. With China, China is the factory of the world. The world depends on it for finished products. And then you have Brazil, which is also a very large economy, in South Africa. And now you have Saudi Arabia starting to reach out to Russia and China and Iran. This is a big problem because the United States policy going all the way back to 1948 is that the U.S. must control the economy, and they must. This is U.S. policy. They must be able to defeat any other economic competitor. And that's what we're seeing today. So the conflict in Ukraine, which I would argue is a proxy war between Russia and the United States, or between U.S., NATO, and Russia, but NATO really, I mean, the U.S. totally dominates NATO, so it's a proxy war.
NATO was born out of the Cold War. After the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the Cold War was supposedly over, this bloc not only persisted, but it grew. Some have argued that the reason is to actually maintain the unipolar world order. How would you respond to that?
Yes, so NATO, when the Soviet Union collapsed, a deal was made that Russia would not extend one inch between the U.S. and Russia. And of course, that changed, particularly under Bill Clinton. And now NATO has expanded right to the edge of Russia. And that includes nuclear-capable missiles that are stationed in Romania and Poland. They're now talking about admitting Finland, and they're talking about deploying nuclear missiles in Finland. There's an 800-mile border on Finland between Finland and Russia. So Russia has been making noises about red lines ever since. Vladimir Putin gave an important speech in Munich in 2007 and talked about, this red line, and also talked about how the United States is trying to dominate the entire world. And that was the first time that he talked about this idea of a multipolar world. I think that the answer is very clear that NATO is, I don't believe it ever was, but it's clearly not a defensive alliance. And in fact, the mandate for NATO is expanding. So it was NATO that directed the attacks on Libya, that destroyed Libya and resulted in the execution, the torture of Muammar Gaddafi. And Libya had the highest education rate in Africa. It had the highest income in Africa. It had the best human rights record in terms of women in Africa. And now there are open slave markets in Libya. And that's all because of NATO. And then what NATO did in Yugoslavia, setting this precedent, this responsibility to protect. And of course, Russia is using that, and they're pointing to the attacks on ethnic Russians that have been going on since 2014. Approximately 14,000 Russian Ukrainians have been killed, overwhelmingly civilians. And that was one of the big rationales for Russia getting involved and say, this has got to stop. So I believe you're right. I believe that NATO really is an offensive weapon, and now it's even being used to target China. And there's discussion about integrating Japanese defense forces into NATO standards.
Is the perception of American weakness, be it due to the leadership of Joe Biden or whoever is in the Oval Office, is that premature? Does America have any means to stop or slow the loss of power?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So there has been an argument, including amongst the radical left, particularly some of the Trotskyist organizations and intellectuals, that the United States is a failed power and that the real new imperialist is China. And they point to the New Silk Road, and then they point to Chinese economic activities throughout Africa and throughout Latin America. But I think that's a little bit too simplistic. The United States is still militarily very strong. It has tremendous residual economic influence. The dollar is still the major mechanism for trade. It's not clear how long that's going to last because a number of analysts, including Bloomberg last week, are now calling a global recession inevitable 100%. But I think it's premature to say that the U.S. is finished and that China is the new imperialist. If you look, in fact, I have a survey was done by Cambridge Union, came out yesterday, and if they polled people around the world about attitudes, so the West, quote unquote, which is a little over a billion people, and we all know who the West is. 75% have negative attitudes toward China, 87% negative attitudes toward Russia. But if you look at the rest of us, most of us, 6.3 billion people, the attitude, positive attitude toward China is 70%, and the positive attitude toward Russia is 68%. So this is a, you know, I mean, a clear-cut example of what I mean when I'm talking about a multi-power world. And this is inevitable. My concern is that the United States and its allies are not going to permit this to happen without kicking or screaming. And we still have approximately 14,000 nuclear weapons, armed to the teeth, launch on warning, and we no longer have the anti-ballistic missile treaty, we no longer have the intermediate forces treaty, we no longer have the open skies treaty, and those were the three treaties that were designed actually to raise the threshold to nuclear war to make it less likely. So all in all, it's a very dangerous time that we're living in, and I think that the answer is an informed populace and translating what we all know is overwhelming support for nuclear disarmament into concrete, making that a concrete political reality.
All right, we'll have to leave that right there. Thank you so much, John Steinbach of the Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Committee. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And that is going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.